Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This is the summer Roe v. Wade was overturned. The summer of state-by-state fights about the future of abortion rights. The story is just beginning. So who should reporters be talking to? What stories should they be telling, and how? Those are a couple of the questions for this week's Reliable Sources podcast. So let's cue the music. I'm Brian Stelter, and this weekly podcast is our chance to go in depth with media leaders and newsmakers, talking about the story behind the story. The landscape for abortion rights in America is changing, in some cases by the day or by the week. And it is now a priority for many news outlets to be covering the changes, the political fights, but also the healthcare realities for countless individuals. So with abortion becoming a kind of state-by-state story in the U.S. more than before, and with so many people wondering what's going to be changing in the months and years to come, I asked two top reporters on this beat to join me here on the podcast to talk through how they approach the subject, how they find people to interview, how they make sure to prioritize the voices of those affected by laws. The result was a really interesting conversation with two of the top beat reporters who cover this subject. Shefali Luthra is a gender and healthcare reporter at the 19th News. You can find her work at 19thnews.org. And Alice Miranda Olstein is a healthcare reporter at Politico. You can find her at politico.com. All right, so let's get to it. Shefali Luthra, welcome to the Reliable Sources podcast.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And Alice Miranda Olstein, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So let's get started with a little bit of background. I'd love to know what brought you both to this beat, to this topic area. First of all, Shefali, I sometimes describe this as the abortion beat. I don't know if that's the best phrase or the best term. How do you describe your beat and what you do at the 19th?
The way my beat was technically defined when I came on board, and what I think it still fundamentally is, the intersection of gender and healthcare, right? And thinking about healthcare as a gender equity issue. In practice, abortion rights are just such an important topic right now that it's sometimes really hard to conceive of stories within that framing beyond that. But it's kind of why, I mean, reproductive healthcare at large, right? Abortion, contraception, the costs of giving birth, for instance, to me, all of those link together under this coverage umbrella.
A year ago, how much of what you were writing about involved abortion, reproductive rights versus now?
Well, we are a few days shy of the one-year anniversary of Texas's six-week abortion ban taking effect. Mm-hmm. So if I were to go back to a year ago, we would be in some ways what is sort of the last kind of era where there was really bandwidth to think about much else. And I'm sure Alice as well, we were writing a lot about like COVID as well and healthcare costs and all of these other factors that are really important and do have really dramatic implications for gender equity. But even before then, the idea that abortion rights were about to become really important was looming, right? I mean, the Supreme Court had just a few months prior agreed to take up the Dobbs case. And for any of us who is on this beat or has been for a while, it just sort of felt that we were in that quiet period right before this was going to be a tremendous story.
And Alice, what about you and the way you view your beat? I mean, looking at your 10 most recent stories for Politico, some are about the Inflation Reduction Act, Democrats trying to push through healthcare reforms. But, you know, then there's four stories in a row about Kansas and about abortion rights there. So how do you describe your beat?
Sure. So I really have two beats. One is Congress and what they are doing on the healthcare front. And the other is, you know, sexual and reproductive health. And so that includes abortion, that includes contraception, that includes, I did a year-long fellowship on STDs, which are actually at record rates right now. And so just, I juggle both of those. Either one could be a full-time job. So, you know, try to be really strategic about the stories I choose and what to prioritize to, yeah, to really be here in this moment. And I want to second what Shefali said. You know, a year ago, we and many others saw the writing on the wall. As soon as the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case and reconsider Roe versus Wade, activists on both sides were telling us, we are preparing right now for a post-Roe world. We see it coming. So it was really only, you know, much of the public and a lot of the people in power in Washington who seemed not to see it coming, but many, many people did. And we were writing about it at the time and writing about what those activists were doing to prepare.
That's interesting. Is it ever frustrating to you when you're hearing rhetoric or reading other coverage and folks are acting surprised by something that you saw coming for a long time?
Yes and no. Of course it can be frustrating. And it's also, you know, frustrating when you see news organizations sort of be a Johnny come lately and do similar pieces to ones you did 6 months ago and act like it's a big scoop. But, you know, of course, this information is important. It's important to get out there. And sometimes people need to see a slew of stories to really have it hit home, or they need to see different kinds of stories in different formats. And you really never know what you're doing, what kind of impact it could have. And so, you know, here we are in this moment where this issue that we've been covering for years is really in the spotlight. And I just feel a lot of responsibility to rise to this moment and do the best and most responsible and hardest hitting reporting I can.
Yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes the national news cycle is like a series of fireworks in the sky where, you know, it suddenly explodes and burns really brightly for a moment and then disappears. And something like the Supreme Court decision reversing Roe v. Wade, you know, it flashes really brightly. And then, you know, the news cycle moves on. And now we're talking about the FBI at Mar-a-Lago or whatever else it is. But for people, for news consumers, this is an ongoing daily story. So let's talk about how you all are telling those stories. Shefali, what are some of the examples of those stories you've been telling in the weeks, almost 2 months since the Supreme Court actually ruled?
I think what's been so deeply important to me has been trying to prioritize the voices of people who are affected, right? And so I try and talk almost daily to folks who work in clinics or who have experience helping people access abortions, right? Whether they work at abortion funds or in other advocacy type roles. I think they are just seeing their day jobs and their whole life's work change every day, every week. And that feels really important to stay on top of, because these are the voices that can help us better understand what the end of Roe actually means for the people who matter most, right? The people who are trying to access reproductive health care in a world where many of them no longer can. I've been trying to think a lot more about just talking to folks who are trying to access abortions. I think that's really important. And it's something that I'm trying to turn my attention to now, especially as we see a little bit less of the intensive day-to-day news coming out of all the states and all the White House and Congress. And I think these types of characters, this type of reporting, will be really essential in taking this from sort of dry kind of policy legalese into something that is more compelling and something that readers can really understand, right? Which is looking at the people of all ages, of all walks of life, of all reasons who are trying to get abortions, and conceiving of the impact of this story beyond the really tragic and right important case of, say, a young girl in Ohio, and thinking a bit broader, right? And thinking about all of the examples of people who are affected. I sometimes worry that that's lost in our media coverage of this.
That's a really great note. I want to put a pin in it and come right back to it. But Alice, what about you for you know, someone who writes for Politico, you know, an outlet for political junkies and those who love them? And, you know, you're a Capitol Hill reporter. So do you feel that same obligation or responsibility to make sure you're including the voices of people affected, the people who are seeking abortions? Because, you know, you're also, you know, dealing with lawmakers and quoting them.
Absolutely. So I really see it as, you know, two sides of the same coin or two pieces of my mandate. So it's both about, you know, lifting up the stories of people directly affected by policy, but also grilling the people who are making those policies, whether it's here in DC on Capitol Hill, whether it's the folks in the Biden administration. Mm. And right now, state lawmakers, state attorneys general, these are the folks who are really going to be deciding going forward who can get an abortion, under what circumstances, and what the punishment might be for doing so. And so I think really making sure both those pieces are there is what we're aiming for. And because I'm just one person and there's so many states and so much going on right now, you know, I'm really trying to look less at, you know, individual cases, individual state fights, and more about, you know, the broader themes that are happening and really linking together developments in many states at once to give people a real picture of what's going on.
Is it fair to think about this as state by state? Is that the best way to think about the landscape now for abortion rights? Is that state by state, or is there a better way to frame it?
The decision that the Supreme Court made kicked it back to the states to determine whether or not abortion is legal. Roe versus Wade protected abortions early in pregnancy. States could still ban abortions later in pregnancy. But so, yes, this is a state-by-state fight. But I also think that, you know, not only is it overwhelming for reporters to try to cover every single little development, I also think it's too overwhelming for readers. And I think they can get lost in this onslaught of this state did this and that state did that. And, you know, there are state court decisions that ban abortion and then it gets stayed or overturned. And it's just so hard to track all of that. If it's hard for us and it's our job to do it full time, think how hard it is for the average person out there who, you know, has their own job and their own life to follow this. And I think that really makes readers feel discouraged and just not want to read any news at all. And so that's why I think, you know, I've tried to focus on these bigger themes. And, you know, even when I went to Kansas, I wrote about Kansas as an example of, you know, this new age we're in where anti-abortion activists overturning Roe versus Wade was not the end goal. It was really just step one. And now we're in this new phase where they are attempting to change state constitutions and battle it out state by state.
Right.
If I can sort of echo and build on what Alice said, I think all of that is just so right and so smart. The other thing that I sort of think about is it's not even just individual states, but we have regions of the country, right? One of the reasons Kansas is so important is because of where it literally functions geographically, right? Near Oklahoma, near Texas, relatively near Louisiana, Arkansas, Alabama, all of these states that are restricting or have eliminated access to abortion. Yeah. And even bigger picture, I think one of the things that I have been really trying to sort of tackle in my framing of this story, and I think will be a theme for the coming months and years, is that even though a lot of these laws are driven by individual states, the impacts are regional and ultimately they are national, right? Because we have abortion clinics in Maine and in New York seeing patients traveling from states like Oklahoma and Texas. And to sort of treat this as, oh, a court in this state or a legislature in this state passed this law, that's accurate and it's important, but I think it in some ways misses the whole story, right? Which is that this is a national issue being dictated by individual states.
So before we move away from Kansas, since it has come up several times, Shefali, what are the next steps with regards to abortion rights in Kansas?
There are so many. I have my eyes on the gubernatorial election in November. Laura Kelly, a Democrat, is seen as this really staunch protector of abortion rights. She has really been sort of this line of defense against a conservative, strong majority in both the state House and Senate that is otherwise very inclined to pass more restrictions, even within this constitutional protection that was maintained. I think that is going to be a really important and tough race. And then beyond that, I think we need to keep watching what happens in the clinics in Kansas, right? Because the clinics there have already told me that they are overwhelmed. I just keep thinking about one in Wichita, Trust Women, who told me they get 1,000 calls a day sometimes, and that if they booked everyone who called them, they would be just booked out indefinitely for maybe 9 months to a year. We know that until now, clinics were really hesitant about trying to expand their presence in Kansas or open new facilities there because they were concerned that abortion rights protections were soon to be eliminated. And I think there's a good question now as to whether with this vote in the rearview mirror, that changes and we do see Kansas become this abortion access point that it really could be. And then I think Alice might have insights on this as well, but trying to understand, if we can understand, what this vote means for how people in general might respond to abortion-related ballot initiatives, and if direct democracy is something that might end up shifting the calculus in states that otherwise would be inclined to ban access.
Alice?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a key piece of what I've been looking into. And there are already rumblings after the Kansas vote of how folks in other states can get something similar on the ballot to protect abortion rights. I think this has really given a lot of energy into the folks that were already looking at that as a key tool and strategy. And so in some of the online groups that I was monitoring ahead of the Kansas vote, people are already talking about volunteering to knock on doors and collect signatures in neighboring Missouri to put something on the ballot there. And so, you know, that is not possible in every state. Only some states even allow people to do these citizen ballot initiatives. And some states are actually working right now to make it harder to get something on the ballot. So it won't be possible everywhere, but I think it's possible in a lot of places that are right now on the front lines of these battles. And so it's something we're definitely tracking going forward. And it also, you know, as a healthcare reporter, reminds me of how many states have passed Medicaid expansion through ballot initiative over the last few years, including some really red states that folks might not expect to vote that way. And so both with that and abortion, it's just an example of, you know, what can really happen when you separate the specific policy issue from, you know, partisan candidate politics.
Right. So we mentioned earlier the case of the 10-year-old in Ohio who traveled to Indiana to seek an abortion. This, of course, was international news. I remember leading my Sunday Reliable Sources program with it, spending the first 10 minutes talking about it. And yet there's a little part of me in the back of my head that wondered, right, are we focusing, and I say we in the collective, right, when we focus on a case like that, what are we missing? What are we leaving out? So Help me get my head around this. Alice, is the right word to use? What's the right word to use for the case of the 10-year-old girl in Ohio? Is it an extreme case? Is it a case on the edges? What, like, how should we think about that in the context of this broader issue?
This is something I've really been wrestling with a lot. So I think that this post-Roe environment is bringing to light just how common a lot of these really horrifying things that aren't talked about in polite society really are. And so I think it is shining a light on just how prevalent, you know, rape and sexual assault is, just how prevalent, you know, abuse of minors is. And in all of the back and forth and over the case of the 10-year-old, when there were folks trying to argue that it wasn't true and it was fabricated, and then others, you know, once it was proven to be accurate, saying, oh, well, it was reasonable for us to question it because of X, Y, and Z, and this is so rare. But one of the statistics cited in by the folks who are arguing that it was rare is that in Ohio, there were instances of pregnant minors that were, you know, 52 in the last year. That's one a week. That's not rare. That's horrifyingly common. So I think that it is important to put it in context and to say, look, this has been happening and is happening, and these new abortion restrictions are bringing it to light in a new way and, you know, further traumatizing these victims. But I also think that the more the media really sort of only highlights these sob stories, there is a lot of concern in the abortion rights advocacy world that doing so sort of throws everyone else under the bus and creates a paradigm where there are quote unquote good abortions and bad abortions. And it promotes the idea that some people deserve them and others who may have, you know, as an adult having consensual sex, become pregnant, don't want to have a kid, have an abortion, that somehow that is not acceptable. And so I think it's important to really show the full spectrum of the people who are seeking this procedure and why they are doing so.
Shefali, how do you see this?
I think that's exactly right. And it's something that I have really been thinking a lot. Alice makes a really good point, right, that the sexual assault of minors is much more common than perhaps we would like to discuss. And that is something that was missed by a lot of folks. And the thing that I have been thinking about more, though, is I do think that in the national press and honestly on Capitol Hill, there is this real instinct to gravitate toward these cases that are just so jaw-droppingly horrific and not to think about other cases where abortion can be seen by the person who is pregnant as really essential, right? But maybe they are 18 years old and would have gone to college and now can't because they're going to have a kid. And I think we should be really cautious as we sort of prioritize these different stories, because why isn't that a story worth telling? I think it is. And I hope that we as journalists can interrogate internal biases that we may have in terms of how we decide whose stories are newsworthy and whose are not.
Well, there's a lot more to talk about, so let me fit in a quick break. Much more on the Reliable Sources podcast in just a moment.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And we're back here on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with Shefali Luthra, the gender and healthcare reporter at The 19th, and Alice Miranda Olstein, healthcare reporter at Politico. So it seems to me one of the stories of the summer with regards to the abortion rights is unintended consequences. You wrote, Shefali, about doctors not having answers as clinics are overwhelmed. And Alice, I noticed Politico, you and your colleagues at Politico just put out a question to the audience. It's titled, "How are abortion laws affecting your access to healthcare? We want to hear from you." So you all are out there asking people, basically, tell me if I'm wrong, my impression is you're looking for sources. You're looking for stories from people who are having a hard time getting certain prescriptions filled, not because they're even seeking an abortion, but just because certain medications are now coming under scrutiny in some states. So Alice, first to you. Tell us about that effort now to go out and find sources for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are trying to do a little crowdsourcing and trying to find folks out there who are being impacted by these. They might not even know that these new abortion restrictions are the reason they can't get their prescription filled, or that they're, you know, turned away by a doctor or whatnot. And so, you know, we want to really track what's happening on the ground and, you know, putting out the call to people to see how we can best do that. You know, at the same time, we are working through existing organizations in all of these states that, you know, have networks and are doing this monitoring on their own, you know, and we are talking to medical workers and state lawmakers, just really trying to talk to everybody we can. You know, the closer they are to this issue, the better. I think that the couple trips I've taken outside of DC this year to report on this issue have been really illuminating. I think that, you know, not only does DC itself have, you know, very progressive abortion access laws, although some of it is limited by Congress because we don't have statehood here. But I think that because of that, and because of, you know, the sort of general DC bubble, it can feel a bit of a distant theoretical issue until you really get out there and talk to the people directly impacted.
Shefali, tell us about examples of that that have applied to you as well. I'm sure there are a lot of them.
Yeah. One thing that I'm thinking about that I've just been so struck by is, I mean, if we rewind a bit, a lot of the laws that are now being enforced were written when people really didn't imagine that they would ever be enforced, right? And now they've taken effect. And what has become very clear is that they were not written in consultation with physicians or other sorts of medical and health experts. And one thing I've been really struck by is access to care for people experiencing ectopic pregnancies. The bill that was passed in both chambers of the West Virginia House, right? Although it still has not come out of conference, so we don't know if it'll ever become law, but that would have required minors seeking abortions because of an ectopic pregnancy to wait 48 hours unless they were in some form of medical emergency that the actual doctors in the state, when they read the bill, could not understand what it meant. And what this means is that we are, in fact, seeing laws that, separately from, right, this quote-unquote elective abortion, are functionally denying people emergency medical care that otherwise would have been allowed. I think this is going to be a really important story that only grows more important, right? Ectopic pregnancies are quite common, and that's something that we have heard talk about, but we perhaps should be hearing more discussion around. And then the other thing, of course, right, is miscarriage care and in vitro fertilization. There is just a lot of concern and unanswered questions about how laws restricting access to medication abortion, which requires the same pills as miscarriage care does, and how these quote-unquote personhood bills and laws, which would affect, right, a fertilized egg, what they will mean for people who are trying to seek these other forms of healthcare that are quite normalized in the case of miscarriage care, right? Really, really important. And in the case of in vitro fertilization, right? Very sort of accepted in a way that abortion has not been. And I don't know, I'm just really struck by how little consideration there has been for these forms of healthcare by the people crafting laws now and in the future.
I think that's really helpful perspective to hear, you know, coming from a reporter who's been living this for years, right? You've been on this beat for years. So you can give us a sense of how prepared or unprepared or expected or unexpected some of these outcomes are. And so basically you're looking around and saying, these lawmakers didn't know what they were doing. I mean, that's kind of what you're saying.
I'm thinking a lot about, God, the first really big abortion story I remember covering was in 2013 when I was this fledgling intern at the Texas Tribune. And that was the year that the state passed their giant abortion restriction, which at the time it had a 20-week ban, which, wow, at the time that was really unheard of. And it also, more importantly, had a bunch of limitations on how clinics could operate that led to a lot of clinics being shut down, even though the law was later struck down by the Supreme Court. But watching the lawmakers who had introduced the bill talk about it, what was very clear was that they hadn't written it. They had gotten the bill largely from advocacy groups, maybe made some minor changes and just put it forth because this was seen as the politically advantageous thing to do in the state house, not because they had given it any really deliberate thought about what it would mean.
I think you're also seeing some of this come up now. And, you know, it sort of reminds me of, you know, Republicans banging their chest for years and saying, we're going to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. And then when it came time and they actually had the ability to do so, they were tearing each other apart over exactly how to do it. And you're seeing something similar here. You know, we recently wrote about all of these red states where Republicans in the legislatures are just going after each other and accusing each other of supporting baby murder and using really heightened rhetoric over, you know, exactly how to craft these laws. And it's one thing to pledge to ban all abortion when the Supreme Court is stopping you from doing so. But once you are fully responsible for the consequences of the laws you're creating, it's very different. And so, you know, they are realizing that, like Shefali said, you know, the way they're drafting these laws or the ways the laws are already drafted on the books, you know, could ban IVF, could prevent someone from getting, you know, life-saving emergency medical care in the event of a miscarriage or an ectopic pregnancy. And yet when they go to try to add exemptions or, you know, moderate the language a little to account for situations like that, then some of their colleagues accuse them of, backtracking or blinking or, you know, not being pro-life enough. And so it's a really fascinating dynamic right now.
And as we think about all the stakeholders, the constituencies, gosh, I hate using those kind of political terms, but I'm wondering where do voices of, I know where the voices of the most intense anti-abortion activists come from. We hear their voices in stories, we read their quotes, and we. But what about, you know, what about the average American adult who goes to church on Sunday and has had concerns about abortion for many years? Do those voices come through in the coverage? When we think about the healthcare beat, and it's obviously the people you're interviewing are folks who are heading to clinics and seeking abortions and seeking those services. But are we fully hearing from the other proverbial side of this story? Or is that a crazy question?
I think that's why things like Kansas are so illuminating, because, you know, you hear anecdotally that, like, you know, more average Republican voters than you might expect, you know, do support abortion rights. And Shefali can testify on this too. Polling on abortion is notoriously unreliable. Like, tiny changes in wording completely change how people respond. You know, both sides can hold up polls and say, look, people support my position. And so it's really illuminating when you have a real world test like the Kansas vote, where you do see that a lot of Republicans are supportive of abortion rights.
Or at least just want the option to exist in some form somewhere.
Correct. Right? That's a good point. They do not want to give the legislature the ability to completely ban abortion is really what was before them.
Mm. Shefali, I've been so interested in the kind of Venn diagram overlap here between religious views and views on abortion, because I sometimes think that the religious component is left out or maybe not always visible in news coverage. So what would you add to what Alice said?
I think it's really complicated, and I think Alice hit on that really well, which is, I mean, we do know there are a lot of people who quite genuinely believe that all abortions are murder and should be prohibited as such, right? I mean, I've spoken to a lot of them, right? Whether it is the people protesting outside clinics or the ones who wait hours to protest or testify at a state house. And I think you're right. I mean, those are important voices. They are part of this discussion. But the voices that I think are heard perhaps even less and that are to me more interesting are the folks who are religious and who are part of a faith that may or may not support abortion, but who personally live in this in a more complicated way, right? I can think of many folks I know personally or have spoken to, right, who just are really, for instance, devoted Catholics. Someone I'm thinking of right now who goes to church every Sunday and would not get an abortion for herself, would not do many things for herself that are not allowed under traditional Catholic teachings, but who was really, really troubled when Roe v. Wade was overturned because it concerned her that her worldviews were being put on other people. I think that is just the kind of in-between sort of complicated viewpoint that doesn't fit in that nicely to the dichotomies that we often build in Washington-based journalism. And in part because people are hard to find, real people are hard to find. But I hope that we do, because those are the voices that matter too, and that just should be part of our conversation as well.
Right.
And just quickly, something that's been fascinating to me and that I've really tried to lift up in my reporting are the voices of people. You know, often, you know, there's a lot of focus on younger people being more progressive on this and many other issues and older people being more conservative. And while that can be true, I think I've been really fascinated to hear so many women who experienced life before Roe versus Wade really coming forward and sharing their stories, whether, you know, people telling me stories of getting an illegal abortion before Roe and how harrowing that was and how it, you know, changed her whole life and made her want to work so that no one else experienced that ever again. And, you know, in Kansas, I talked to one woman who got pregnant as a teenager before Roe versus Wade and, you know, because it was illegal, you know, went ahead and had a baby, and it was really hard. And she doesn't know what she would have done if she had a choice, but she didn't. She didn't have that choice. And I think, you know, the vote in Kansas and the age breakdown shows that there are a lot of older people who are influenced by, you know, having been here before, even though it's completely new territory to a lot of us.
I want to just thank you both for these fantastic insights. I'm lucky I was able to even peel you away for a few minutes because you're all both busy writing so many stories this summer. So Alice, Shefali, thank you both for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Brian. This was really fun.
Great to be here. Really good discussion.
And that's a wrap here on this week's Reliable Sources podcast. Thanks for joining us as always. We'll see you Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on CNN. And thanks so much for tuning in.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.